Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung. Crossing boundaries. Limiting this term only to cultural differences between nations is definitely not enough. Only cross-border visions in architecture, urban renewal, and the debate on resources provide a breeding ground for future-proof architecture. A close examination of local contexts and its traditions allows to open up for experimentation and sustainability. The development is based on new technical processes and materials, always keeping a focus on the value and quality for its users. In today's podcast episode, we talk to Binke Linhardt from Cross Boundaries in Beijing about how boundaries can be shifted again and again and which methods are used in order to achieve the best results. We are Diana and
Katrina from Jung. Founded in 2005 and organized as an international partnership, Cross Boundaries has offices in Beijing and Frankfurt. The staff's origins are spread over Asia, Europe, such as North and South America. Therefore, Cross Boundaries offers unique spatial solutions resulting from local cultural knowledge and transnational expertise. Hello and welcome to our Jung Architecture Talks podcast. Nice to have you with us today, Binke.
Hello from Beijing.
Binke, you studied and worked in Germany and the USA, and your partner Hao Dong in China, and finally met you in the USA as well. So I think I remember it properly that you've been working in the US together, no?
Yes, that's true. Yes, we both met during graduate studies in New York, and then we also worked for a little bit of time in New York before we went to Beijing. Or before we moved to Beijing.
So the question was whether to move back to Germany or to China. And I think it was a big step for you to move to China, actually, with Hao. And together, you've been running the office in Beijing now since 2005. And you've established a further office in Frankfurt in 2012. Your team comes from different nations and disciplines. How does this multicultural and multidisciplinary approach influence your way of designing?
Yes, the multicultural background. You said it already, but I just explain it one more time. So Hao is Chinese and I'm German. And we both met in America. So basically we met in a country which is none of our own. Country. So it was for us a new environment where we met. And he is male, I'm female. That's another difference, despite the cultural difference. And when we met, at least I can speak for myself, I found these different backgrounds, the cultural backgrounds and our different upbringings, very appealing and inspiring, of course. Mm-hmm. And then when we made this step to go to China, and eventually opened our office, this mix we found until then also still very inspiring and interesting. So basically we set up a rule, but we didn't really set it up as a rule, but we decided that we wanted the office also to be such a mix, consisting out of half male, half females, half Asian or Chinese, half foreigners, or Chinese with foreign education. And that's actually what we have until the very day, that we have these kind of different people with very different backgrounds. And this is basically the multicultural background we have. And then this plays in the way of working. If we work together, and this is a kind of working where we exchange a lot of ideas, we have obviously very different opinions. Even if we would be all Chinese, we would have different opinions. But because we are from different places with different backgrounds and different ages, of course, we have maybe even more different opinions. So that's why, first of all, this multicultural background causes a lot of diversity by default. So when it comes to this way of working, we kind of like, you know, the more the merrier, like the more different opinions we have, the more variety comes into play, the more solutions we believe we can generate, or the more different ideas we can come up with. And in these open discussions we discuss a lot of things. I mean, it's not always possible, but most of the time we are able to do this, engaging in conversations with most of the staff. And this, in our opinion, is a very collaborative process. And we do believe in this because we think that this causes us to be more creative in what we can produce. Because, I mean, if we are very honest with ourselves, and you don't need to be in a creative profession to know that you only have a certain amount of ideas you can come up with yourself. And if you have other people which come from different angles or from different backgrounds, they bring in their own ideas. So you can multiply these ideas very quickly, and then you can choose between the best ideas. So this is kind of the process we are having or we are working with. One thing we talk about is kind of this multicultural background. The second is the way of working. And then the third is maybe the multidisciplinary aspect. So we are architects. Maybe 80% of the people in the office are architects. There are some other people who have background in graphic design, urban planning, or landscape. But this is still within our own field. Like, it all belongs kind of architecture and is in the area of architecture. But then there are all these people outside the field, like, for example, artists or event managers or educators. We do a lot of educational building, so there are a lot of teachers, parents maybe eventually. Then there are people who concentrate on market studies, research consultants. You know, when we have buildings in other cities, we need to know more about the demographic backgrounds. So all these people help us to define the content, to consider what functions maybe are necessary for this building, which help us to redefine the brief, which is maybe given out initially by the client, or maybe sometimes there is even no brief and we have to develop the brief. So basically, these three things I mentioned are kind of the ingredients for our specific design process. That's how I would explain this.
I have a question too. I mean, how went back home and you moved into another nation, culture, country? What are the advantages of, like, how is in his origin country and your second office is in Germany? So is it an advantage for you to have one office in your origin country and so you didn't stay in the States, so where the both of you were not from there?
I think I have to go back a little bit. So we discussed what we want to do, where we want to go. So we both were in America, and then for me, basically, the time was up. I had a Fulbright scholarship, and this has the requirement to go back to your home country to bring the benefit of the exchange back home. So for me, it was clear I have to go back for certain. So that was the first kind of pressure we had, or kind of inevitable thing coming up. So, and then there was the option, okay, what do we do? I go back, I wait until I can come back to the US. That's option one. Option two, I go to Germany, and Hao also goes to Germany. And then option three was, maybe there is a third option, which is China. So, and these three options were, of course, not so clear in front of us when we discussed it, but basically there were a lot of other things coming into the equation. One big event, which was September 11. And this was actually, I think, what kind of made us change our mind, because I had a great time in the US, and both of us had. And I was thinking I will go back there. And then this happened, and then everything else changed. And it's a similar situation as we have now with the pandemic. Like, all of a sudden, I mean, it was not so global, but a lot of things have changed for people in that moment. And for us, that was also like this. So basically, Hao was still in New York when it happened, and I was already just that couple of weeks before I left for Germany. So he experienced it over there. I was in Germany. And then we already had planned our trip to Beijing. That had nothing to do with September 11, but in October we had this trip planned because he wanted to go back and he wanted me to come along to see, you know, Beijing and meet his parents and all this, you know, everything around it. So basically he experienced September 11, he came to Germany, basically picked me up and we flew to Beijing. And then for him it was kind of this homecoming, have a look, show me everything, and he was kind of thrilled by this, you know, development there. And then what also had happened in that summer was the Olympic Games were decided to go to Beijing. So this was another key factor. So basically, everybody we met, they just said, what are you doing in the US? You have to come here. Here it's where the development is going to be. So basically, these are really...
Sounds very welcoming too.
Yeah, I mean, the parents definitely wanted him to come back just because it's a son who should come back. But also a lot of friends and people we met, they were just very excited about, you know, all these things which were going to happen. And it was already, you had this spirit already, you could sense it. And that time, that very moment, I really had no idea about going to China. And I didn't want this in this moment because it was for me, I mean, I had a cultural shock in the other direction. How had the cultural shock probably for the US? And I had it then when I came to Beijing, and it was dry, it was hot, and I couldn't find my way. You know, it was very hard.
A shock on many levels.
Yes, exactly. And then when we went back, I went back to Berlin, and Hao went back to New York after this vacation in Beijing. And then I started to think about what are we going to do. So I started to do a lot of research. Like I read about German offices, and I was thinking of where he could work, where I could work in the future. And, you know, this kind of thing. Then I was thinking what would be going on in New York. Then he basically fed me the information of his ideas of the city in New York, what he observed, how the city was changing because of this, you know, September 11. And then I started to look into China. I started to look into how would it be for me to go to China without speaking Chinese, you know, all these kind of issues. Because we are like, you know, the way I grew up, I want to be independent. I don't want to, you know, just go somewhere and be not able to work or be not able to do what I like to do. So I started to look how to do this. And then I found a program, which I found very interesting back then. It's from the German Academic Exchange Program, DAAD. And it's called Language and Practice. And it would give me the opportunity to study Chinese and then work.
Yeah, it's a good program. I know that.
Yeah. So I thought I can apply. Let's see. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit too old already. Let's see. Maybe I get in. Maybe I can. So I just thought, okay, I think it's interesting. Let's try it. And then if I get this, we can go. And then I went through this procedure and I applied and I got this scholarship. And then I just said, okay, now let's do it. And that was it. That basically a year later, we left for China. And that was basically all the considerations I had done to this very point. I mean, I didn't consider how it would actually be then to live in China. And we planned this for like 2-3 years, and now it's 18 years.
Wow. What an interesting background story. Very nice. Let's step on to your projects. Many of your projects are educational institutions. In Germany, there's this expression, space as a third pedagogue. What is your formula for a good educational building, which can be also accepted by everyone?
Space as a third pedagogue, or maybe the environment as the third teacher, we would say like mm-hmm. this. I don't think we have a real formula for educational buildings, but it's rather a checklist or like a changing. I mean, it's not a fixed checklist, but an ever-changing checklist, which also depends, of course, on how old are the children for who this building is, or how is the environment around it, what's the vision of the client, or how much are teachers involved, or even maybe parents or other stakeholders. So it's a little bit depending on what else plays into this particular project. But there are a couple of points which are important. For example, one is that the spatial experience we try to design has a certain variety and is also diverse. And that is related to the building as well as to the landscape. We sometimes have to think also from the children's perspective to understand how they would maybe see this space to be diverse or interesting. So first is so variety and diversity. And the second is maybe also to blur the line between outdoor and indoor. We all grew up probably in these normal classrooms, which have a teacher in the front and we sit in rows. And then maybe we have, of course, the windows to the outside, but there is not really a direct relationship from this classroom to the outdoor, just as an example. So if it's possible to extend this classroom to the outside, to maybe have a door directly, if it's on the ground floor, then this would be something we would, of course, push for, because this is what we mean with blurring the indoor and outdoor boundary. It's basically the outdoor space can also be a classroom, if we talk about classroom in this context, because that's another point which I would bring up. A school or a learning environment doesn't need to have necessarily classrooms anymore. Or maybe the classroom also becomes a changeable classroom, like it can open up or it can be part of a public area. So this would be also another point to bring up here. This is the third point about the classroom. Then maybe there is also the fact that you have to give opportunities for free play. So it's not so much that you define areas. When we talk about smaller children, like you design playgrounds and you basically program what they are supposed to do in these playgrounds, but it can be rather more open so that they invent their own play in these areas. And that they actually understand the whole learning environment to be, you know, a free space where they can basically learn how these different functions work. Like, for example, that they can understand that if there is a kitchen, how do they cook in this kitchen? And if there is, you know, if there are certain features of the building, like sustainable features, that they understand why this is sustainable. Basically, you expose the building to the children, and it's basically an understanding which help, I mean, obvious understanding for them. So it's not so much like the building is a normal building, but it's kind of an open building. Yeah, so these are a couple of points. I mean, there are many more. The classroom, what I mentioned before, the classroom can spill out. You have the hallways, which become part of the classrooms. And then you have to also see in China, there are only a few very innovative schools. And there are a lot of more other schools, let's call them normal schools or traditional schools. And there you cannot do too much with the classroom because the client, I don't want to say they don't want it, but it's just certain areas in China are just not ready for this, like second tier, third tier cities. They still need this normal learning environment. So what you can do there is then you can work on the corridors. You can, you know, make the corridors more lively. You can create breakout rooms. So it's very different. It really depends also on, you know, client and all these factors I mentioned earlier. But I think there can be key factors which basically are on this list and which should be followed.
Yeah, the open space concept for a classroom would also be a big advantage during times like these now, during a pandemic, for example.
Yes, that's true. It's just that we also noticed, of course, that, I mean, we had these schools where we planned those, but there are these other people who come into place, like they are the teachers. And the teachers, of course, also need to be able to use those spaces in the way they are meant to be used. And that's basically the next step which has to be done. They have to participate this design phase, and they have to also work basically on the design in order to give input on how they would like to use it. Because we cannot cross this line. Like if we design something very open and they feel like, you know, intimidated, or they feel like it's too open, they cannot keep the students concentrated, then it's a lost cause. And this is something which we noticed at some of the buildings we did, that we have to adjust it in a later stage a little bit, like we put some glass walls in and stuff, so that it has to be a little bit of a compromise. I mean, you cannot achieve everything right away. You have to slowly try to push for these changes.
I know quite a lot of your school projects and educational buildings, and maybe for our audience, if you are interested in seeing some of their projects, there are two options, actually. You have a beautiful website, which is crossboundaries.com, right?
Yes.
And the other option would be to see a lecture which Hao gave a few months ago for us together with Henning Larsen on educational buildings. And you can have a review on that on jung-group.com, where we have an archive for our architectural lectures. And you can see some of the beautiful projects Cross Boundaries did in that way. And there is another point to mention, actually. A striking feature of your project is the use of color as well. It's quite refreshing and nice to see your projects. And I think it's still unusual to work with colors in that way. Would you say that we should generally be more courageous on using colors within architecture?
I would not generalize it like this. It really depends a lot also on the context. Like, we did this one project, I'm not sure if Hao showed that, but it's like this village kindergarten in Jiangsu. And this basically has almost no color, meaning like it really only uses the local colors, which is the gray brick and white plaster. And in the inside, it has a little bit color. Like, there is this little art room, which is pink. And then we have another classroom, which is orange. I think there, in this environment, we also went to see existing kindergartens and schools, and they just overdo it with the colors. So basically, our reaction to this kind of setting was to basically stay away from the color and rather let this kindergarten tune itself into this rural setting. I think there also, I think it was understood also by the children that basically this cluster of buildings is an imitation of a village, kind of, and they took it as their own. But let's say in a city environment, where, especially in Chinese cities, that at least is my Western perception still, is I feel there's a lot of repetition going on, like a lot of, like, because we have these housing blocks where you normally you see four or six of them in a group. So there is a lot of repetition. And in order to break this repetition, I do think that color actually can do something good. And also, you make these educational buildings then easier to be recognized by the general public. Because, I mean, I'm not saying just because the building is colorful, it means it's an educational building. But if the color is applied smartly or in a color system, then it does something, it gives some value to the neighborhood. So this is kind of the experience we made. But all the colors we applied, they are applied with a color system. They're not just random colors or like a little bit red, a little bit blue or whatever, but there's a logic behind that. And normally this logic is probably not understood really by the user, but they can also feel that there is a bigger meaning behind that. So this randomness of color is not doing it. It has to be really applied with a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
I believe so too. Binke, a special feature of your office is the knowledge transfer activities. You work with particular design thinking methods, notable process-based learning to actively promote the change of perspectives between the user and the planner, and also the shifting of borders. Please tell us more about that. We're so curious.
We started basically to get involved in a lot of educational buildings. And one kind of key project, and also very important, where there was a lot of exchange with the client, was this Soyo project in Zhengzhou. This is a project very complex and went fairly quick, but it took a lot of, you know, discourse. And for this project, we noticed, because it became quite complex in terms of the functions, that we would need to also explain to the client and to the user how to use this building. And that was actually at a point in time where we started to write down a manual on how to use this building. And basically every area we gave examples on how they could program this, what they could do in the fall, in the spring, in the summer with the children in this building in a certain area. And while we were doing this, we, of course, became very curious of what you can do with children. And then, so all these things, this is all a process. So this was the first time where we kind of did this manual on how to teach basically the user how to use the building. And then we became interested in what the children can do there, what they can learn. And then we started to become more curious on how we could teach children ourselves. Then we started to develop classes or courses in which we would start to try to tell children on how they can creatively think of solutions. Basically, we used our studio. We have a big open space on the lower floor where we can have it set up to have different groups basically working together and then basically meeting up again to share their ideas and what they were thinking about. So basically, we then applied certain ideas on children classes. Basically, it became this, what we could call a participatory experiment. So we asked children to participate certain processes. And also learned in that course that their approaches are very playful and very simple, but very effective. And in this kind of course, we try to make it also become more, you know, research-based. And we, of course, got involved in, you know, we read a lot about how we can train children and what they are actually lacking in their own education at school. And then we start to train them on this, what we call, I mean, it's a common knowledge, but the four C's, basically the critical thinking, the creativity, the collaboration, and the communication. So basically, these were the goals set for these classes. It's basically about experimental learning and experimental education. And that actually at the end also eventually could be applied to the client as well. I mean, now we are talking about, you know, we are talking to children and we are trying to reach out to them because we think in their education maybe something creative is missing. But eventually we could also do these kind of workshops with clients and help them to develop their briefs a little bit better or more in detail. It's a cycle which can be closed at the client.
Yeah.
Maybe as an additional point here is like, I mean, we don't need to elaborate on the difference between East and West, but it's still that a lot of things in China, and this is basically where the Beijing office mainly has projects, the way people think here is different, and also the client structure is different. So you need to also start at different points and you need to consider things differently as you would do this maybe in Germany or in the West.
There is another point actually we would like to speak about, which might be a little bit different comparing Germany and China. It's about the debate on climate protection, like sustainability, resources, the use of modular construction is gaining a lot more importance in Germany, for example. How does modular construction already plays a major role in China? And how important is the climate protection getting?
The modular construction is important in China, but I think the reason why it's important is different than it is in, for example, Germany. I mean, basically here, there is always this pressure of fast construction or fast completion of a project. I think modular construction in this sense is very effective because you can very fast build something very big. I mean, yes, it's very important, but it's important for another reason. An example, like we completed a school the beginning of this year in Shenzhen, and that was out of this pressure to have a school building very fast because they didn't have enough seats for students. So we planned a school, 50,000 square meters roughly, in planning plus construction like 13 months. And this for us was also very challenging because you basically plan while they already construct.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, there is some time, but there is a lot of overlap also. And for the Chinese climate, these kind of like prefabricated modular construction, climate, I mean, like the market, comes very handy because the deadlines are very, tight. And you can use this to build fast and you can also, even though you are not able to do the whole project in prefab, you can take advantage of the low cost of the labor and, you know, close the gap of the not prefabricated part with traditional building methods. So basically you build 70% in prefab and the rest you do in a conventional way and it's still fast because it's only 30%.
Mm-hmm. And it still makes sense.
So, and it does make sense in China because still labor costs are lower. And so they can put more people on and then they're still fast. But in Germany, the characteristics of this modular construction is just very different. I mean, there the goal is to be very precise and basically plan everything ahead and then only construct it on site. And then there is no more labor involved or not too much labor involved. It gets assembled on site and then that's it. And there's not too much extra work. So these are really the major differences I can see, even though in China, there's a lot of technical know-how involved, like there is BIM and a lot of things also happen. But on the thresholds, they deal with these things differently. So like, for example, for this Jinlong project we did, each of these panels, which was basically put in place on site, had a QR code. The idea was that you later could be able to track where this panel was fabricated, like which factory. And then you could also track where it maybe had an error, where there was a source of error. So this kind of thinking, I think, is the right direction. It just doesn't work fully yet. Also because of the speed, because these projects don't allow for a long planning phase. They have a very short planning phase. So the construction phase for this project I was talking about was still longer than the planning phase. In this case, you need to, you know, compromise somewhere. And that's where this difference comes from. I think there is still a lot of room for development, and I think it will become better and more, you know, precise on the way. But at the moment, it is just not. And there is one more difference also that I don't know if it's in Asia or like only in China, but there is not so much critique about this prefab construction. Like in Europe, you know, we grew up like seeing prefab rather as a, you know, socialist kind of development. And now basically the new prefab is kind of undergoing a sort of rebranding, I think, in Germany. So we want it to be different from what we remember to have like a poor aesthetic visual appearance from like 30, 40, 50 years ago. We in Germany, we have maybe a negative association with prefab, but that's also quite different in China. They are more like, okay, we need it fast, let's just do it.
So not focusing on sustainability.
Well, I do think that, you know, this QR code is a way which goes in this direction, because if you localize the source of mistake and then you can basically also, you know, in the factory make a change, that goes into this sustainable direction. But it's just at the moment they still lag behind, because first of all, they need buildings. In Germany, we don't have this lack of buildings. I mean, we do have that too, but not in this amount. Like here in China, everything is right away like thousands of square meters and not hundreds of square meters. In Europe, we also have shortages, but these are of a much different scale. And first, I think here is still about building a base. So once that is kind of established, then there come the next questions. It is, of course, on the agenda. And that also has to do with the pollution we experience here, that people became more sensitive. So basically, this is also a process. Like since I'm here, like at the beginning, when I came in the beginning of 2000, there was not so much pollution, first of all, but there was also not so much sensitivity. But then, you know, there were Olympic Games and all this became international requirements. And then also basically the Chinese people became very sensitive. So, and that will be the same for the building sector, that eventually that will also pick up and the standards will go up. But at the moment, the standard is just not high enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also related to basically this huge difference between East and West. You know, in the east or the coastline, you have a lot of very big cities. And then in the west, you have the countryside, and the development in the countryside lags behind. And that's why first you need to also have a certain base level covered. So, and that's what still is happening at the moment.
I remember when I've been in Beijing the first time, that was, I think, 2011. I wasn't able to see the sky for many, many days, just due to the pollution. But nowadays, it's completely different. It seems to be so much cleaner within the cities, which is, I would say, definitely helpful for the people also living in there.
I mean, these days, it was again not so great. I mean, today was a very gray fall day, like with rain and stuff. But
same here in Germany.
Yeah, so that's maybe global
weather.
Yeah, so this is obviously man-made, but I think the way is really to make people become aware of it, and then they will also take action. I don't think that by default, like, you know, the Germans are sustainable or more sustainable than other countries. This has to be initiated by the government. So the government has to push, like, you know, you have to pay either taxes or you have to pay for your garbage bin. And if it's expensive, you will try to save money on, you know, producing less garbage. So these kind of things can be pushed by the government. But here in China, it's also hard to push for these things because the country is just so uneven in terms of the economic development. I mean, you can maybe push this in a city, but you cannot push this in countryside. So I think it's still about slowly kind of lifting up the overall standards, and then can also introduce higher standards in the cities. And then you slowly lift up the standards in the countryside. And anyway, there should be a different goal for the countryside. The cities have other pressures than the rural areas.
Absolutely.
Binke, currently, what projects are you working on?
Currently, we are working on, I would call it urban renewal project in the area of Tongzhou, Songzhuang. So it's a little park where we have kind of, we call them rooms. Like every 100 steps, you have a little room where you can do something. Like you can sit and you can play cards, or you can sit and, you know, enjoy the seating together with your neighbors. So this is kind of a small park with a little running, like a pathway going through. Then in the same area, we do a couple of houses, like a cluster of buildings. So basically, it's kind of connected to each other, these projects. Then we have a building which we have to refunction. I don't know how to call that. That's kind of, it's an existing building which was in operation, and now the client wants to bring in new functions. And these functions will happen only in part of the building. So these functions kind of spill out onto the facade and they go inside. It's a little bit of a hybrid kind of project. We will add areas on the roof, like some more commercial areas. So this is kind of a project ongoing now, where we also did a feasibility study first, where we basically developed the program or the functions for this, for the building. Yeah, we do another interesting project. I mean, we do always kind of, I think our projects are all very interesting. One project is a project which is under construction, but we basically stepped in while it was under construction. So basically, the original design is not from us. So we now are changing basically the construction.
Is that the planning construction story in China, which is parallel?
Yeah, well, so these are these kind of different ways of refurbishments here, or working with existing buildings, because some of them are in fact existing, but some are in construction, and then you start getting in there. So basically, in this case, the client kind of changed his mind and wanted a change, and then we stepped in as a game changer, and now we have to deal with the existing construction. So we cannot change everything, obviously. So that's kind of a very challenging, I think that's the most challenging scenario, where something is basically under construction. So basically you have the time pressure, basically the floors, like every day, every week, every is something else coming up. And in the meantime, you need to see where you can actually still implement some change if you want to change. Yeah. So that's another project which is ongoing.
Binke, we're coming to the end of our podcast session today, and I would have two last questions for you. One would be, what is your wish for our future, and what boundaries do you want to cross in the future?
Oh, I think for the wish, I think first I wish that it's not a long-term wish, it's a short-term wish. I wish for the European countries and basically the countries who still have the pandemic ongoing, that this is kind of resolving itself very quickly. Because, I mean, we have kind of normality here within this China bubble. We can travel, and I'm very happy to have this back and to be able to do that. So this is, I think, something I can easily wish without any constraints, because I think it has been quite hard, I think, for everybody. And everybody knows somebody who is having trouble with the virus. So I do think that this is something I really wish that it will happen soon, that it will resolve itself very quickly. Yeah, so that was the wish. And what was the other question again?
What boundaries do you want to cross in the future?
That's even a bigger wish.
Yeah, that's a big wish. I think any boundaries that there are, I mean, what we do now, at least what is our belief, is that we are crossing the boundaries in our area of expertise. But of course, it would be nice to do this in other areas too, like being able to communicate to other groups, to other people, because I do think that this is the challenge for us, for the next generations, also to be able to stay connected. Because we got hit by this pandemic, we basically can see the boundaries of the globalization. So basically, because we are so globalized now, this pandemic actually could spread so easily. So now I can see as a danger that basically we will all fall back into our own countries or own areas. And we see this already, like everybody is trying to, you know, focus more on themselves. So I do think that we should keep on pushing the boundaries and keep on pushing for this exchange and for this understanding of this different cultures and environments, because this is something still ahead of us. I mean, we have a lot of problems to solve and we can only solve them together. So, I mean, I don't know if it makes sense because I do feel that there are more boundaries now than there were before the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I think this is also related to the situation we are in now. I mean, maybe in 2 years I would answer this differently, but now in this context, I think that's kind of how I would, you know, answer this.
I'm very impressed by those words to the end. Very beautiful. Thank you so much. And also thank you for your time, Binky. We really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah,
We really enjoyed talking to you. And I think we could go on listening for a while.
Well, there is a lot to talk about in general.
Yeah, that's right. And also many thanks to our listeners. If there are any topics or speakers you are especially interested in, then please let us know at architects@jung.de. We heartily invite you to the upcoming Jung Architecture Talks podcasts. Look them up on jung.de/architects and tune in with us.